This episode of Continuing Mission is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Continuing Mission, our look at the ways in which fans are keeping Star Trek alive. I'm your host, Christopher Jones, and the primary focus of this show is on the fan series, or as I prefer to call them, independent productions, that tell new stories set in the Star Trek universe. We usually talk about specific series, films, or games, but the process of creating the finished product is fascinating as well. On a previous show, we talked about voice acting, and today we're going to jump into the visual realm, as we're joined by Tommy Kraft, creator of the Enterprise-era film Star Trek Horizon, to talk about shooting, processing video, working with green screens, creating visual effects, and much more. Hello, Tommy. Welcome back to Continuing Mission. It's been a while since you've been on this show. I think last time was when I had you and Mark on to talk about Horizon.
Yeah, thank you for having me back. There's been a lot that's happened in between then and now. It's been a few months, actually. Seems like when you had me on, it was like episode 4 or 5 or something like that of Continuing Mission.
Maybe so. I think it was early. Yeah. Of course, you come on Warp 5 in the Ready Room from time to time, so we've done other shows together, but Continuing Mission, it has been quite a while.
Yeah, definitely, but there's been plenty to do in the meantime, and the other shows have been fun too, so it's always nice to come back.
Yeah, great to have you. So today we're going to do another sort of different Continuing Mission show. On the last show, I talked about voice acting, and I had Michael Liebman on, who's been in many, many audio dramas to do voice parts. And I thought it would also be interesting to share with people some of the behind-the-scenes process from the video production side. Now, you're working on your Enterprise-era film, Horizon, and you're using a lot of green screens for that. You're doing a lot of video work on that to do it on a really shoestring budget, but it looks fantastic. And the skills that you're using to put that together, as a designer myself, but someone who doesn't do very much video work, I really find it fascinating. And so I wanted to learn more about it from you today. And I'm sure the listeners are going to find this to be really interesting as well.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the kind words. It's a very complex and detailed process that has evolved over the past couple of years that I've been working on Horizon, and that has evolved even before I started working on Horizon with my short films, which I did, I don't know, probably like 20 or 30 short films before I did Horizon. So it's been definitely a learning process, and something I can talk about for hours. So hopefully we have enough time.
I think so. I mean, as we were talking, we're probably going to do a couple of shows on this, maybe at least a two-parter here, spread it out a little bit in release, but ultimately, we'll probably have multiple parts for people to listen to about a video production. You know, the thing that strikes me is how, and I see this in my own work too with technology, but I think it's especially true with video. The power that we have in computers today and the software that we have has made it possible to create independent films that we could have never dreamt of in the past. You would have really needed a Hollywood studio and a Hollywood budget, but you're doing a lot of this stuff literally in your basement. So let's start off with just talking about, you know, some of the techniques and the software and the tools that you use that are available now that are making it possible for you and for others to create indie films.
Well, I think the first biggest innovation, which almost goes without saying, but has to be said, is being able to shoot such high quality content on a medium other than film. Because shooting film is such a huge pain, where the buying the film itself has always been expensive. And on top of that, motion picture cameras are almost impossible to buy unless you can get them secondhand. You might be able to get like a 8mm or 16mm, but if you want to buy a true 35mm film camera, you really have to either rent it from one of the major houses or hope you can get a secondhand. And it's always been that way. And so now that we have things like the Blackmagic camera, the Red cameras, and well, actually, there's a lot of cameras by those two companies alone that do RAW, and the RAW is the big thing. But now that we have all these digital cameras, it makes this kind of work so much easier. And so the biggest thing for me when doing this kind of green screen project is being able to shoot RAW. And of course, for those who don't know, the basic difference between shooting RAW and shooting in any other type of codec is that typically your footage or your pictures, you can shoot stills in RAW too, get encoded. They get compressed into these formats where you lose a lot of data. It might not be visible to the eye, but if you lose that data in the in your image, then you can't do as much post work with it.
You know, I, with photography, which I do as an amateur, not as much these days, but I have over the years, the way I explain RAW to people who aren't technical when it comes to still images is that it's like your unprocessed film negative before you take it to the photo mat, which is probably an old word, right? And have it processed. But it's that unprocessed negative where like all the data is there, and you could always reprocess that again in the future as your skills and techniques improve as well.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, you're not the only person to use the term negative, because the Blackmagic camera, which is what I use for Horizon, the file format is a format called Cinema DNG, which stands for Cinema Digital Negative. And the only difference with where confusion might arise in calling it a negative is that it doesn't look like it still looks like a photo. It doesn't look like a traditional negative, but with the with the digital negative, you have all that data there where if you have something that's maybe too blown out, you can bring down the exposure and it won't be blown out anymore. You can bring up the blacks, whatever you need. And then there's a lot more technical stuff in there too, like the fact that the way a sensor records colors is compressed on the pixel level in traditional codecs. And so if you blow up a picture to like 400-800% on an encoded image, you will find that the edges around your contrasty areas, so for instance, if you're shooting green screen, the edge between your actor and the green will be much smoother in a RAW file than in an encoded file, because you don't have that compression acting on those little pixels there. Essentially, that's...
And so that makes your compositing work easier
and
more accurate.
It makes it easier and more accurate, and most times that makes it look better too, because you don't have to wind up crushing your colors as much, essentially, to get those edges out. But aside from the major advantage of being able to shoot RAW so cheap, because even just a few years ago, your only option was Red digital cinema camera, and those are really expensive. We're talking like $20,000 and up, and the Blackmagic is now $2,000. And so, yeah, it's amazing how fast it comes down. On top of that, the other really important things for green screen is to make sure you can light your screen separately from your actors. So you really want a couple of lights to put up on your screen, and then you want a couple of lights to put on your actors. So we're talking, the way I have mine set up is I have three LED lights on my green screen. And a good reason to use LED is because they have a blue cast, and digital sensors are blue deficient. And so having that blue cast helps you get a little less noise in your screen. And then I have I have four tungsten lights that I have for my actors. So it's not a huge setup. The screen is like, I think, 10 feet wide. by like 40 feet. So you can cover the whole wall and come out onto the floor quite a ways. And it's all just set up in my basement. So, I mean, we're really, for the cost to get set up, we're talking like a couple thousand dollars maximum, I think. Compared to a few years ago, you'd be paying, you know, at least probably 20, 30 grand.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. So, well, while we're talking about tools and we're talking about cameras here, of course, once you shoot the stuff in RAW, you have to put it in the software. And so, and that's another area where, I mean, the software. So I started out as a magazine designer, and I started out in the days where, you know, the average person couldn't do this stuff at home. You had actually no very like pro level applications. But these days, the kind of work that I've done for most of my career, you know, people can do this at home. The software is cheap, the computers are powerful. And so it's the same way with, of course, you need the skill, you need to learn it, but you can learn it. And it's sort of the same now with things that Hollywood production houses used to do that you can do with your own home computer because it's powerful enough and the software is powerful enough. So tell me a little bit about the software that you use to process all of that raw footage.
Well, the key thing you said there is you have to have the skill. And that's because, you know, even with, like you said, the processing power of computers, a few years ago, you really would have needed to go into a studio to do a lot of this work because you just wouldn't have been able to handle not only the footage, but the visual effects side of things, where you have all these applications that just require huge amounts of processing power. And the thing is, the software that everybody is using now has become so accessible that the pros are using the same software, pros with air quotes that you can't see me doing, but the pros are using the same software as the indie people. And all the software I'm using is the same software that ILM uses or any other effects house. The difference is they have programmers there that will actually program specific plugins that cater to their specific needs when they need them. But all of the base applications are the same. My main squeeze for 3D visual effects is Autodesk 3ds Max. And I use V-Ray by Chaos Group for the rendering. And I use their Phoenix FD plugin for any type of fluid simulation, such as explosions, smoke, water, etc. And then for editing, I use Adobe Premiere Pro Creative Cloud and Adobe After Effects Creative Cloud for any 2D effects or compositing. And some of the stuff is fairly expensive. 3ds Max, you know, goes for like $2,000-$3,000, but I got it at an educational discount when I was in college, and that was the whole Autodesk Creation Suite, which was, I think, $300 or $400.
That's the way to buy it. That's how I got my original Adobe suite as well. Well, there were no suites at the time; they were just individual
that goes back.
Apps. Because this was early '90s, but that's how I got this stuff as well. And boy, I lived off that until many, many years later when finally my company was able to actually purchase, you know, full suites again. Yeah.
Because it is really cost prohibitive for, you know, a single person to pick up a license of 3ds Max or any Adobe product. And we're talking a couple of grand per license. But Adobe is catering now to this market too with the Creative Cloud, which is $50 a month. It's kind of a lot, but if you have any sort of steady income, that is much more preferable than a single payment of $2,000 to $3,000.
Yeah.
And it's and you don't have to keep paying for it either. When your project's done, you know, there you go. And then you can re up your subscription when you need it.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you mentioned 2D visual effects a little bit, and let's talk, because these days so many movies are 3D. What's the difference between 2D visual effects and 3D visual effects? Do you use a different process when you have to deal with those?
So there's a bit of a misnomer to clear up, I think, that a lot of people get confused with who aren't that into visual effects. And that's the usage of the terms 2D and 3D. 3D and 2D and 3D does not necessarily mean that we're going to do a 3D film like you put on the glasses. So the difference is, like, 3ds Max does 3D effects, and basically a 3D visual effect is something that you can you know, this is actually kind of hard to explain now that I think about it. It's something that you can play with in perspective. It's basically you think about like the models of the ships. Traditionally, they would build a real model, you know, a real studio model that was like 11 feet long in the case of the original Enterprise. And now what we're doing is we're doing that on the computer with 3D software like 3ds Max. So it's all virtual. You have this virtual environment, basically. You build a virtual model, which is 3D, because you can rotate around it and fly around at any angle you want and save it into your file.
So within the Star Trek universe, people think about the NX-01, right? Because that was the first lead ship on a Star Trek show that never existed as a model, right? It was always a 3D model. So Star Trek Enterprise is not a 3D show, but that is a 3D model.
Correct. Yes, that's a good way to put it. And then you have 2D effects, which are typically done in something like After Effects, and that is where you do all your compositing to take out your green screen. And for instance, a lightsaber is a 2D effect. It's basically the way that's done is they draw over the colored blade in their footage, and then they turn it white frame by frame, and they put a glow on it, and that's a 2D effect because it's just done on top of your original plain film footage. And so there's basically like this separation where you do a lot of stuff in 3ds Max, and then you bring it over to After Effects to finish it off. And Horizon marries those two a lot because almost the entire movie is shot on green screen, and all of these sets are virtual sets built in 3ds Max. So the bridge of the ship, any alien environments, the Admiral's office are all done in 3ds Max, then rendered into an image file, brought into After Effects, and then composited together with the footage that we shoot on our green screen of our actors.
So let's talk about those green screens a little bit more. You have various different scenes in Horizon, but as you mentioned, in your basement, you have this one green screen. So you're using the same green screen regardless of the environment that you're putting the actors into. Is that right?
Right. And this is where it actually starts to get a bit kind of complicated when you're shooting, because especially when you're shooting on a smaller green screen like we have, where you don't have three green walls to work with, you then, instead of moving your camera whenever you want to change angles, you essentially move your actors instead. And so we have one green wall, and if we're shooting over somebody's shoulder, we'll shoot one angle, and then instead of taking the camera and walking to the other person's shoulder and shooting over that person's shoulder, we're going to leave the camera where it is, and we just take the actors and we essentially have them change seats. But it gets more complicated because then you also have to flip your lighting. So if you had a light primarily on the right side of your actors, then you have to flip that too when you flip your people so it stays on their right side. And you have to make sure you're still going over the correct shoulder and so on. And then this gets even more complicated when you start doing things like action scenes where you have multiple people in a scene with a specific blocking that you need to have played out. So there are certainly challenges to doing this. And there are times, honestly, where I have mess that up and I have to go fix it in post, where I'll put the light on the wrong side and I'll have to kind of fudge it in post to make it look right, because it is kind of complicated to think about.
Well, this sort of brings up the question of how many people are involved in shooting something like this, because it does seem to me that if one person is trying to do it, it would be very difficult to make sure everything is correct, because you're having to keep your eye on so many different things, and also efficiency in shooting as well, how long it takes. Do you require a lot of people to help move those lights so that you can capture the scene that way, or are you doing it yourself?
It would be nice to have a lot of people. Though in the case of the way we're shooting in my basement with this small green screen, it might actually make it harder at times because it is such a small and cramped space. But that being said, there is a trade-off you can do between having too many people and not having enough. And I probably don't do that trade-off very well, because I usually wind up doing pretty much everything myself. So our basic process is we'll bring the actors down in the studio, and by studio, I mean my basement, and we'll rehearse a scene so they can get the feel of it, they can get the flow of it, go through it a few times, and then we'll start shooting. And so I'll set up the lights how I want it for that particular scene, and then we'll shoot a take, and we'll shoot all our takes from that angle, and then we'll flip the lights and flip the actors and shoot another take. And it's usually just me doing all of this. The sound guy who does the boom op will usually help me out with this in some way and keep an eye on it and make sure that I'm not losing my mind and, you know, make sure everything is usually on the right side and such. But as far as we've gone, it's mostly been all me doing it. And that's the way it's been for all of my productions really so far. And some of that is because I have a hard time relinquishing control. And
yeah.
A lot of it, too, is just that I don't know that many people who are really experienced with this kind of stuff and who've done it as much as me. And so it usually just becomes easier and faster for me to, rather than explain it to someone new each time, just go over there, move the light how I want it, and go back to the camera, and so on.
Have you considered putting everyone on a giant green Lazy Susan, and then you just spin it around?
I feel like this, like that's a really great idea for a stoner movie. So maybe for the next project, I don't know.
Okay. And the name of the film will be Giant Green Lazy Susan.
There you go. Brilliant title. I think it'll score box office. But
I think it's,
you know, there's a trade-off because if you get to the studio level, so you think of a big, really big visual effects piece like Avengers or Star Wars, and that gets to a point then where you have so many people, where it's people divided up into teams, with each team having a leader, essentially. And that leader reports to their leader, and it all gets back to the director. And the director basically says, I want to do Captain America fighting aliens. And then the visual effects supervisor says to his people, okay, let's set up this huge green wall. Let's put the lights here. Let's put the lights there. It's a much more removed process, I guess, than the way I'm doing it currently. But there is a benefit to the way I'm doing it, and it's that it saves a ton of money. I'm not hiring a huge visual effects studio or anybody really to come in and do this. And that allows me to do a lot for much less money. It means I'm taking a huge pay cut, technically, i.e. no pay. And it's, but at the end of the day, if it's your passion project and you work 24/7 on it, almost always I'll guarantee that you'll get better results out of whatever you're doing than bringing someone who's not passionate about it and not paying them or not paying them much. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm thinking, you mentioned Avengers, these types of big movies, and I'm just thinking if they shot something like this and then in post they realize there's a problem, we need to reshoot this, that's a major undertaking, it's very expensive to set it all up and do it again. What about for you? Like, how difficult is it for you to reshoot a scene like this in front of the green screen if you find that, unlike you mentioned earlier, where sometimes you can sort of fudge it in post if the light isn't exactly right, if there's something that truly has to be redone, I mean, how difficult is that for you?
Well, it depends on what exactly it is. It's actually a lot harder if we have to redo something to redo one of the few location shoots we've had. Because with the green screen, it's pretty simple. You know, we'll just add that scene back onto the list for a next shooting day and we'll reshoot it. Luckily, we haven't actually had to do any reshoots yet. But I will say for studio productions, they usually actually write that into an actor's contract too, that in addition to the set shooting times, you may have to come back for 3 extra days to do reshoots. And it's almost expected with a lot of big productions that there will be reshoots after the main shoot is done. But luckily, again, this is a benefit of me doing so much of it by myself, is I know exactly what I want from the get-go. And there won't be an issue of having to make sure that everybody's aware of this and that everybody gets it done right. And it saves a lot of time in that way, because I just know what I want. I can go in there and shoot it. And then when I get to the computer, I can put the effects together myself and know how I want it to look and know how I want it to composite. And in that way, it can be easier. But it is also a ton of work because it's all just me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that does seem to be a benefit, right? Because when you're shooting it, because you're going to do the rest of the work yourself, you already know in your head where that's going.
Yeah, it's a benefit at this level. I mean, if I was shooting a production like Avengers, for instance, if I was at that level where I had millions of dollars, it would no longer be beneficial to do it that way, because when you get to that level, you need the extra manpower and you need the teams of people to work on your project. And so it's really a budgetary thing. And I've been very lucky in that way, too, because I know a lot of people who, filmmakers who aren't as interested or skilled with the visual effects. And it does make it a lot easier for me that I don't have to worry about going out and finding, you know, a huge team of people to do this every time.
Even though you'd love to have a huge team
right,
of people.
Yeah,
ideally, right?
Ideally, I would, yeah. And, you know, that's what I'm hoping for in the future with future projects after Star Trek.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about tasks and time. We've talked about various things that you do, including shooting. We've talked about the green screens here. We've talked about the software that you use and the fact that you do the visual compositing and the effects and such. So we'll get into Horizon a little bit more here, because that's what you're actually working on right now at the moment. So with individual aspects of the production and the post-production here, how much time goes into each part of this, and which parts are more challenging than others?
I'd say the most time definitely goes into post-production, because I started shooting Horizon almost a year ago. But the thing is, we've actually only had about 10 to 12 actual shooting days within that time.
Okay.
And so when you think about spending 10 to 12 days, give or take an average day's work time, 8 to 5, just for reference, that's not that much time compared to the fact that I spend almost every other day when I'm not shooting all day at my computer working on effects. So post-production, especially on a green screen thing, is the biggest part. And I'd say that probably the most time-consuming part is building the virtual sets. And that's because of, aside from the ships, those are very time-consuming too. And I should say that I've been lucky to have a couple of other people sign on to help build some virtual sets and ships, which has saved me some time, an immense amount of time. But you have to be so detailed. If you think about the amount of time that any set designer and crew will put into building and detailing an actual film set, and then just move that over into a 3D virtual world, you don't spend any time, you know, cutting the wood. But you spend a lot of time 3D modeling and a lot of time doing your 2D textures that go on your 3D models. And so I would say that definitely that is probably the most time consuming part. And then on top of that, you have to render all that when you're done. So basically you take your 3D model and you render it into a video or a still image that you can composite with your footage. And the renders can sometimes, I've had renders take up to 60 hours before.
Yeah, rendering is an interesting thing, because I know that you recently got new equipment to do your processing and your rendering. What were you using before? What are you using now? And how much of a difference has that made in terms of production time?
Before, I had a single i7 processor. I think it was like 2.9 gigahertz, give or take. And I had I had 8 gigs of RAM before. And now I have two Xeon E5 2620 V2 processors, which are clocked at 2.10 gigahertz. And it may sound slower because it's 2.10, but because I have two of them, and because they have 6 cores instead of 4, and they're hyper-threaded, I actually wind up with the equivalent of 24 cores. And basically, what this does is it more than triples my processing power. So for instance, if I was going to...
And how much RAM do you have now?
64 gigs.
See, that's huge.
Yeah.
A huge difference, yeah.
And one way that really helps is 3ds Max and also Windows will tell you how much RAM any specific application is using. And so for instance, the scene I was rendering the other day, which had two Vulcan ships, the NX-01, the NX-04, and 3 Romulan Tavaro class warbirds, was taking, I think, about 20 gigs of RAM. And wow, like that just wouldn't have flown on my other computer with 8 gigs of RAM. And so having that extra processing power is a huge boon to the process. It took about like 3 hours, 2 to 3 hours to render a 1080p still of my bridge on the old computer. And now it takes about 50 minutes to an hour, which is still a long time, but a lot better. Especially when you consider that you can render a still for a lot of different shots and reuse it. Mm-hmm. So this upgrade to the computer has been tremendously helpful.
You know, I was listening to an interview recently with the guys who created Myst, and they were talking about the original Myst back in the day.
That goes back.
Yeah, and they talked about how they would do the scenes, and they really had no idea how they were going to turn out after the render. And then they would let them render for several days.
Yeah.
And then come back and see what the results were. And it's hard to imagine in today's world doing creative work in that way.
Well, it's funny because the stuff that they took several days to render, you could render in a few minutes on today's machines.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And the funny thing is, the stuff that I'm rendering now, well, still takes several days to render. But, I mean, when you're talking about like a 10 to 15 second shot with 5 to 10 ships in it, that can still take, depending on how close you are to the ships and everything, at full resolution, several days to render.
I think back in the day with Myst, something like that, there would have been several new generations of Mac that were released to the market before that render finished, right?
back in that day, you wouldn't even have considered it. And so it's, and also the nice thing too about having all this processing power is that I can let a render go now, and I can tick a few cores off from 3ds Max so that I can, instead of having Max use 100% of my processing power, it only uses 80, and then I can have enough power left over to go over into Premiere and do some editing, or into After Effects and do some compositing or what have you. So there's definitely a lot of benefits to having this processing power that even a couple years ago, heck, before this project and the Kickstarter, that I didn't have. And this machine cost about close to $7,000 to have built. So it was...
Which sounds like a lot, but really for the power that you're getting is...
Yeah, I mean, it's...
is amazingly cheap compared to what equipment cost just a few years ago.
Oh yeah, and it's the kind of thing that you wouldn't ever spend that kind of money on for just a home computer, but it's technically a server workstation. Yeah. And that's actually a pretty reasonable price for what's in there. And I should say, I also have a Quadro K4000 4GB video card, which by itself has over 1,000 processors in it, which is insane when you think about.
Yeah. It's amazing. Well, of all these individual aspects of post-production that you work on, you know, what's the most challenging for you?
I would say probably, again, going back to the virtual sets. And not so much because, or just the 3D modeling in general. And it's not so much because it's hard at this point. I've gotten a pretty good workflow down, and I know 3ds Max like the back of my hand now. But now that I've been working on this so long, it gets very challenging to maintain the level of detail that I had when I first started with the bridge, when I had to make sure everything was picture perfect accurate down to the correct numbers on the keypads from the show. And now that it's getting much further along in the process, I find the most challenging part is keeping up that level of that high bar that I've set for myself. Because now it gets to a point where it's like, okay, I want to get this scene done. I want to be able to check it off the list. But I think that to briefly go on my big soapbox, that this stuff is available for anybody to learn. And I taught myself how to do almost all of this. And that's not to say that like, oh, I did it, so everybody else can do it. But, you know, the resources are out there, and it is very challenging. It is something I've spent thousands and thousands of hours done doing. But it's not too challenging. It can be a fun challenge. And if you have a passion for it, then I think it's it's definitely doable. And the challenge becomes, how passionate are you? And can you maintain that level of passion?
Absolutely. It's amazing how technology has liberated the creativity of people these days to, you know, allow you to express yourself and explore and create things like this that just maybe they were in your head in the past, but you had no way to bring them out. So absolutely.
And it's a very cool feeling too, when, you know, when you have that visual in your head, that story in your head, and to see it come alive on the screen, and to know that we can do that now, where not that long ago, we couldn't do it the way we can now, where it was something that only the big studios could do. And it was kind of like this unattainable goal. And now it's not so unattainable.
It's not at all. You're doing it. In fact, people can go to your website and see the work itself. So Tommy, this our discussion today, as I expected it would, brought up lots of additional things that I want to know about, specifically related to Horizon. So we're going to have you back. We're going to do a second part to this soon and really dig into the details of Horizon. I mean, I have questions about those digital sets, about the ships as well, and all sorts of things. So we'll come back to this again in a few shows. And until then, give us a quick update on Horizon and tell people where they can go so they can actually see the things that you've talked about today in action.
Well, we have our official website, which is StarTrekHorizon.com. And we have our Facebook page, which is Facebook.com/STHorizon, or you can just find it in the search bar, Star Trek Horizon. And of course, we're on YouTube too, under Project N, as in Nicholas or as in Nimoy. Project N Resource is our YouTube channel. And a lot of my short films are on there from the past, and all of the current video blogs and teasers and opening scene for Star Trek Horizon are on there. And in terms of update, you can look out for a new trailer in the coming weeks. It's going to be really cool, at least I think it is, not to toot my own horn or anybody else's horn that's involved with the project. But I think it should really get people excited for it.
Very cool. Cannot wait to see that. Well, Tommy, thanks as always for dropping by and talking about the technical side this time. I think it was really fascinating.
Well, thank you for having me. I can't wait to come back and do it again.
Well, I hope everyone enjoyed hearing about video editing and that process of creating an independent film today, but it isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm. Standard orbit.
Everything that we do has to exist inside of this little box.
This window,
yeah,
if you will.
Right. And you can do whatever you want inside there, but once you step outside, you know, it's the real world.
Earl Grey.
That's, you know what I mean? And then Star Trek V is all about crapping all over the rest of the movies that just came out.
Axanar, the official podcast.
When you're in the edit bay, as soon as you put one image next to another, it's this instant gratification. It's this great creative jolt, which happens every time you start juxtaposing your images. And when you start seeing things fall into place, it's really galvanizing and it's really thrilling, actually. And I love feeding off that kind of energy.
The Ready Room.
Well, you know, time is not really linear, Char. So the monkey, he's always been there and he always will be.
I take the Janeway stance on time travel. It gives me a headache.
The Orb.
Batman also creates a contingency plan for all the other superheroes just in case something goes wrong with them. So
what does he do for the Wonder Twins, for example? Like, how is he going to take them out?
I think he just separates them internally so they can't smack their hands together.
To the journey! We have like a whole bunch of geek aliens, like they're wearing their own superhero t-shirts, they're eating Hot Pockets, they have headphones on, and they're all in their own little, you know, 24th century room, but they're like, dude, I totally just pwned the Voyager. Commentary, Trek Stars.
And underlines the goal of Prexy Gail Berman to re-energize the pipeline while revitalizing the PAR brand with top-tier talents such as Abrams. I love trains.
You have no idea what you're saying at this point.
Warp 5.
he can put her mind at ease about these kinds of things, because he can just, you know how Trip is, like, let's have some catfish and, like, just hang out. You know, just
thinking that. Continuing mission.
We actually spoke with CBS legal team, and that was one of the things that we had told them, is that all of our visuals were all original scenes. All of our animation was going to be original. All of our music would be original. So we would not be stealing any content from the original era. Mm-hmm. And they liked that a lot.
Literary Treks.
And I just love that, because it is very true. You know, Picard in some ways kind of has that Yoda-ness about him, where he will kind of speak in a riddle and he wants you to figure it out.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. We have new Star Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and you'll find them everywhere you get your podcasts. Just search for Trek.fm and the name of the show you want to listen to, and you'll find us there. And be sure to pick up the Master Feed. The Master Feed is a great way to sample the wide assortment of discussion that we have here. It contains every episode of every show that we do, and you'll find that in iTunes and Stitcher and many other places where you get your podcasts. While you're in those places, be sure to review Continuing Mission and the other shows that you listen to. We love to hear your feedback about the shows, and your reviews also make it possible for other fans to find the show in iTunes, because there are a lot of podcasts out there, and fan films, it's not the easiest thing to search for. So we would love your support in leaving us a review. It only takes a moment. And also, not just written reviews, but if you want to send me a voicemail, I would love to receive that from you as well. One of the ways you can contact us and leave feedback on the show is through SpeakPipe. If you go to speakpipe.com, that's the word speak and the word pipe.com/TrekFM, you can send me a voicemail just using the microphone on your webcam's microphone or on your smartphone or your tablet, and you can upload it right there from the page. So you don't even need to make a phone call. And also, if you look in the left sidebar on the show page on our website, you'll see a little tool for this there as well. So I'd love to hear your voice and maybe play some of your messages here on the show. Other ways you can send feedback include our contact form. If you go to trek.fm/contact, you'll find a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose Continuing Mission, and that will come to me by email. If social media is your thing, we're all over the place there. You can find us on Twitter, where our username is TrekFM. Also, facebook.com/TrekFM. We have a community on G+. We have forums on our website at trek.fm/forums, and I'd love to hear from you through any of those channels. If you'd like to talk to me personally, you can do that in social media. You'll find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. I'm also on Facebook, facebook.com/CBrianJones. Feel free to hit me up there, send me a friend request, and I also have my website at cbrianjones.com. Elsewhere on the network, I do a lot of different shows, possibly too many shows, but hey, I love to talk about Star Trek. There is Literary Treks, The Orb, Warp 5, Matter Stream, The Ready Room, Hyper Channel, and the official Star Trek Axanar podcast, which I co-host with Alec Peters. So check out those shows and find out what I'm talking about in other areas of Star Trek. Before I let you go, I would also like to remind you about Patreon. This is a new way that you can support the show. If you're not familiar with Patreon, it's a lot like Kickstarter, except instead of it being one project, it's a way for you to support the creatives that you love on a monthly basis. So if you go to patreon.com/TrekFM, that's patreon.com/TrekFM, you will see our goals, some of the things that we're trying to fund at the moment. You'll also see different contribution levels that you can make each month and the perks that you get in return for those. Everything from having your name listed on the website to digital wallpaper, all the way up to sitting in on recordings of your favorite podcasts, even participating in a show and getting associate producer credits on the network. So there are all sorts of things for you to get in return for your monthly support. We really do need your support in order to keep the shows coming to you every week. So I do hope you'll go over to patreon.com/TrekFM and see everything that we have over there. We're going to have some exclusive content for you there as well, and also early access to some of our shows. Again, patreon.com/TrekFM, and I really personally thank you very, very much for checking that out and for any support that you can give us. I'd also like to tell you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. Now, they are one of my favorite services ever. I've been a customer for 14 years. They're the best source of audiobooks that you're going to find anywhere. They have 150, maybe 160,000 at this point, titles waiting for you. Lots of Star Trek books, lots of books from many different genres. Most new releases come out in audio format now as well. And if you love podcasts, you're going to love audiobooks. And, you know, you can get them from other places and you can get them on CDs. Yes, some people still do that. I don't know about audio cassettes anymore, although I have some around here. But Audible is the best place to get them. You can play them on your desktop, on all your different devices. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free book of your choice just for trying the service. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up. Choose the book you want, and if at the end of the trial you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you'll get to keep that book. But by trying Audible, you will be helping us keep continuing mission and our other shows coming to you each week because we'll get a little bit of money from Audible when you try out the service, and it makes a difference for us. It really, really does. So go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and try it out. I promise you're going to love it. I vouch for Audible. So thanks to Audible for their support of the show and the network, and thank you for supporting Audible. Well, thanks again to Tommy for joining me today to talk video editing. I think we're going to return to this topic in a few shows because I want to drill down to Horizon specifically and some of the challenges and some of the work that he's doing there on Horizon. It's a great project, wonderful of him to really be supporting the Enterprise era, which, in my opinion, does not get enough love amongst the fan base. So thanks again, Tommy, for joining me. And thank you all for listening. And join me again next time here on this continuing mission. And let's see what's out there.